Hello, everyone, and welcome back. It's been a while, but I'm ready to continue with my regularly scheduled episodes. And, of course, we'll have to start out with a special episode of Late Night Crimecast. But first, I'm your host, Robin Steffens, and every week on Thursday, I'm going to post a new true crime story. I will cover cases that are local, cases that got a lot of media attention, and everything in between. Now, I don't know about you guys, but I'm still in the Christmas spirit, and so today I want to cover a story that happens during the Christmas holidays. So today, we're going to be covering the cabin home invasion of the Tita family. The Tita family consisted of Kay Tidwell Tita, the mother, Rolf Tita, the father, and their two daughters, Lene, who was 20 at the time of the incident, and Trisha, 16. The family had resided in Humble, Texas, but owned a picturesque cabin in the mountains of Oakley, Utah. They would often use that remote cabin for family getaways and vacations, often bringing or meeting up with extended family members such as grandparents, aunts, uncles, and cousins. The cabin was eventually named Tita's Tranquility because of the serenity and peace of it all. The cabin was described as being heaven on earth, much of its beauty reflected in the surrounding nature. Even after the incident, one of the daughters, Lene, she spoke fondly of the cabin, recalling the sound of a nearby river, the horses down in the pastures, and the birds that frequented the area. Unfortunately for the Tita family, their picturesque cabin, known for its beauty, would become the site of a horrific crime scene. This case takes place in the winter of 1990. In 1990, the city of Oakley, Utah was quite small, with a population hovering around 500 people over 6.3 square miles. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. If you're trying to avoid being murdered, stay away from small towns. They are like a cesspool for violent criminals. I feel like someone should do like a scientific study on this because some of the most heinous crimes I've read about take place in small towns, in isolated areas. And that brings me back to this case. As I said before, the cabin was in a remote area. I mean, the cabin is about 2 miles to 2.5 miles off the main road. And in the winter with snowfall and everything, the only way to get to the cabin is to park on the road and then drive to the cabin by snowmobile. So that's how remote it was. Like, you literally couldn't even get there by car. But yeah, so like I said, this family, they love this place and they end up wanting to spend Christmas up in the cabin. They thought it would be a great way to not only spend time in one of their favorite places, but also to get together with their extended family. The family had gone up to the cabin several days before Christmas and set up their huge Christmas tree and placed tons of presents underneath it. They also had stockings under the fireplace mantle, and they had decorated everything pretty much, but they realized about 3 days before Christmas that they had some more shopping to do. So on December 22nd, 1990, they decided to go into town for their last few purchases. Also with them that day was Beth Harmon Tidwell Potts, who was the grandmother to Lene and Trisha and the mother of Kay. They all went together to shop and prep for Christmas as they were expecting more family to come meet up at the cabin. Little did they know what horrors awaited them, because unbeknownst to them, as they were shopping, two men had broken into their cabin. So the family finished their shopping and then made their way back to the cabin around 12:30 p.m. They were in two separate cars. In the first car, there was Lene, the mother Kay, and the grandmother Beth. In the second car, there was the other daughter Trisha and the father Rolf. Lene, Kay, and Beth arrived to the cabin first. As usual, they parked their car on the road and then they took their snowmobiles the rest of the way. Lene was the first to get inside of the cabin. Her hands were freezing in the cold winter air, so she had asked her mother to hurry and open the door so she could run inside, run her hands under warm water, and then come back outside to help them bring in their Christmas shopping purchases. But as Lene got into the cabin and to the top of the stairs, she saw a flash of gray behind the refrigerator. Initially, she thought that it was one of her cousins that had finally arrived, and she wanted to take the opportunity to sneak up on them and give them a scare. Unfortunately, that just wasn't the case. Because from behind the refrigerator came a man in a gray sweatshirt with his pistol drawn. Lene, thinking that this man was only there to rob them, called for her mom. As soon as her mother came to the top of the stairs, another man with thick Coke bottle glasses came out from the back bedroom. He was also armed and pointed the gun at the mother. With their guns pointed, the men ordered all of the women to come inside. So they came inside, and the grandmother Beth, she sat on the bar stool while her daughter Kay stood right next to her. They had tried to reason with the men. Kay's final words were, "What is it you want? Why are you here? I'll give you anything." The men, they didn't even say anything. They just started firing their weapons. Kay was the first to be hit. Lene had turned around after her mother was shot, just in time to see her grandmother get shot in the head. She saw the blood splatter, and she heard her grandmother take her final breaths. And then, silence. At that point, Lene was being taken hostage by these men. She had begged and pleaded with the killers to let her call an ambulance, but they ignored her and instead bound and gagged her. After that, the men talked about what to do with the bodies of the two dead women, and they eventually decided to throw their bodies off a balcony. Lene heard and watched all of this play out, unable to do anything, all while knowing that her sister and her father would soon be on their way to the cabin. The father, Rolf, stated that he knew something was wrong as soon as he approached the cabin with his daughter, Trisha. And he was absolutely right. The noise from the snowmobiles had alerted the two criminals in their home, and as the sound got closer, the man in the gray sweatshirt grabbed Lene from behind. He put his arm around her neck and put his gun on her back. As soon as Rolf and Trisha got to the cabin and off of their snowmobiles, the man in the gray sweatshirt, along with Lene, popped out from the garage. He pointed his gun and demanded that they come inside right away. They all went inside, and from there, the other man with the Coke bottle glasses pointed his gun at Rolf and demanded that he take off his clothing and give them all his belongings. Immediately, Rolf complied with all of their instructions. He emptied out all of his pockets and tried to give them everything that he had. They took his belongings, and then the man in the gray sweatshirt told his accomplice to shoot Rolf. And so the other man, the one with the Coke bottle glasses, he raised his gun, but he didn't pull the trigger. And because of this, the man in the gray sweatshirt decided to take matters into his own hands. The first two attempts to shoot the father failed, but it was on the third pull of the trigger that the gun discharged and a bullet struck Rolf in the face. After being shot in the face, Rolf fell to the ground. But he was still alive. He played dead and listened to the two men talk. They talked about setting the cabin on fire and taking the girls with them. Then the men were back standing over Rolf. One of them shot him again in the back of the head this time. Rolf was just barely hanging on to consciousness when he felt gasoline being poured over his legs, back, and then his head. Shortly after this, Rolf hears the snowmobiles start and then fade away. Then it is silent, and he's finally alone. By then, the fires had started burning around him, so he gets up and tries to put out some of them. But unfortunately, in the process, he catches fire as well. But still, this amazing man who has literally been shot in the head, not once, but twice, he just removes his burning clothing, which luckily he was wearing a huge, like, snowsuit. But he removes it and he continues to try and battle the blaze. Like, can you imagine? I don't know what kept him going. Maybe it was the adrenaline or something. But he kept this up for a while before realizing that it was just too much for him to put out on his own. So while this is happening, the girls are also going through their own harrowing experience. Lene has seen her mother and grandmother shot to death and probably assumes that her father has been shot to death as well. And while Trisha didn't see her mother or grandmother shot to death, she probably assumes that they're dead and that her father is dead. So, of course, they hear the men talking about setting their beloved cabin on fire. They see them douse everything in gasoline, including their father. And then they see the men light the fire. They can hear the fire alarms going off, and they can literally see the cabin going up in flames as they are forced on snowmobiles and kidnapped. So they're actually driving the snowmobiles, each with a man behind them. And as they're leaving the cabin and approaching the front gate, they see their uncle, Randy Zorn, standing by the gate. He has just arrived, so he has no idea what has occurred. He's just waving to the girls at the gate, and the girls, they're just forced to speed past him and ignore him because they fear that if they bring any attention to him, if they do anything else, they will get their uncle killed. So immediately the uncle knows something is wrong. He just doesn't know what. So he's still trying to get the attention of his nieces. He thinks that the men behind them are their boyfriends, but they're definitely not. The girls, they're forced to drive the snowmobiles for 2 miles until they get to their father's car. The men then force the girls into the car, and the men are driving this time. They speed off again past the uncle. So the uncle, Randy, he sees the family car zoom by with his nieces in it, and he tries to run up to the car, but they are just too fast and they speed off. So he goes back to the main gate and sees another snowmobile coming his way. But in this snowmobile, he can tell that this person has no coat on, no gloves, no helmet. And not long after that, he realizes that the person on that snowmobile is his own brother. It's Rolf, and he's in bad shape. He managed to leave the cabin, but he is covered in his own blood. His eyes are swollen shut, and he has literal blood sickles hanging from him because it's that cold. So you have this man who is critically injured, shot twice in the head, with no winter clothes on in the dead of winter. And you know what he says? He says that he has been shot, that his wife has been killed, and his daughters have been kidnapped, and that he needs help. He can't even see out of his eyes. I mean, I can't even imagine having the strength to speak. So it's so crazy to me that the first thing he does is attempt to get help from whoever is there. When you know what he's been through, and that he was even able to drive the snowmobile and still try to get help for himself and his family, that's just, he's just like a super dad or something. So yeah, Randy hears this, he sees the condition of his brother, and he puts him in the backseat of his car. He then calls the police, tells them about what has happened, and that he needs his brother airlifted to the hospital because his injuries are so severe. From there, the operator informs Randy that they're on it, and then Randy tells them of the direction that the car was heading, and the police take over from there. With the information that Randy provided, the police mobilized to capture the suspects and save the girls. A deputy who was actually responding to the incident first spotted the suspect's car heading south. He then gave chase close to 10 miles, where they drove speeds of more than 90 miles per hour. At one point, they even drove through a roadblock. So this is a full-on high-speed chase. And during this chase, an officer from Kansas even joins in pursuit. They go through several towns, roadblocks, barriers, and winding mountain roads. Then finally, the police are forced to fire at the vehicle, forcing the car off the road and into an embankment. After this, the men quickly surrender, and Lene and Trisha are left unharmed, physically at least. Now that I've told you about this crazy, horrific story, I finally want to focus on the criminals that did this, because the story's not really over. There's just so much to say about this case. So the men who actually committed this crime was 21-year-old Edward Deli and 25-year-old Vaughn Taylor. Taylor was the man in the gray sweatshirt and essentially the one who had planned the attack. They were both convicted criminals on the run. Taylor had just been released from prison in October of 1990 for a conviction on an aggravated burglary charge, while Deli was released in November of 1990 for arson. On December 14, 1990, Taylor and Deli left a state-owned halfway house that they were supposed to be staying at. Deli and Taylor had hitchhiked their way up to the area where the cabin was because Taylor actually had family that owned a cabin in the area. They spent several days on the mountain and they broke into numerous empty cabins. On December 22, 1990, Taylor telephoned a man named Scott Manley, who's actually an inmate at another halfway house. Taylor told Manley where he had been staying and explained that he had broken into other cabins in the same area and stolen guns. He informed Manley that he was waiting in a cabin for the owners to arrive and that he was going to kill them and steal their car. So essentially, Taylor and Deli had somehow seen the family coming in and out and were waiting for them to return, so they planned this attack. This was further proven by a video found by authorities. They found a video camera in which they thought they would find a video of happy family, you know, celebrating Christmas. But no, instead they saw a video of Taylor and Deli opening up Christmas presents that belonged to the Tita family. These men filmed themselves opening up their presents and destroying their property. They seemed to have no care, even knowing what they had intended to do to that family. They had no care in the world. But soon after that call that Taylor had made to Manley, Manley went and informed officials at the halfway house of Taylor's call and of his intended plans. But the state failed to respond to the information. So, in all honesty, this tragedy could have been prevented, which is so crazy to me that all of this could have been prevented, but it wasn't. Instead, it went ignored and the men went on to murder, kidnap, and basically cause mayhem for that family that very same day. Taylor and Deli were scheduled to be arraigned on January 22nd, 1991, and they were each charged with 2 counts of first-degree murder, 2 counts of aggravated kidnapping, 1 count of attempted first-degree murder, aggravated arson, theft, and aggravated robbery. Taylor pled guilty to 2 counts of capital murder, and the state dropped all other charges against him in exchange for that plea. He was still given the death sentence. Deli was convicted of second-degree murder. He was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 62 years. As for the remaining Tita family members, the father Rolf actually passed away in 2008 with his family at his bedside. But not before rebuilding the cabin and, according to Lene and Trisha, making it better than it was before. Both Lene and Trisha now have their own families, and they still go to the cabin to enjoy it with the family and friends that they do have. Even though they experienced something horrific there, and even though they had their mother and grandmother taken away from them there, they weren't going to let a place that they loved and enjoyed so much be taken away as well. So yeah, that is it, guys. That is the end of this Christmas special podcast. Crazy, crazy story. Literally a wild ride from beginning to end. I was really, 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 I just couldn't even, you know, stop reading about the case as soon as I started reading about it. So I definitely recommend you guys look into this, look in some of the court documents. It's crazy. That's how I found out that actually that the state had known that these guys had planned to commit this crime, but they just didn't do anything about it. So I definitely recommend you guys to look more into this case. It's very interesting. It's very crazy. And there's actually a whole 48 hours special on it, and you can find that on YouTube. But that's it. I just want to say that I'm so very excited to start up with season 2. I'm so happy to be back, and I can't wait to bring you guys more true crime cases. I will be back next Thursday with a new true crime case. So until next time, guys, bye.